Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global politics and international life. My name is Jonathan Pryke, Director of the Pacific Islands Program here at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As the crisis unfolds, we are sitting down every week with experts and policymakers in a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on our homepage of our website. The Pacific Islands region is in many ways a darling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Through a lot of foresight and a little luck, the region has taken quick action to lock down and have, touched wood, managed to dodge the worst of the health impacts of COVID-19. But this action, and action taken in key trading partners like Australia and New Zealand, has come at tremendous economic cost that will be felt in the region for years and decades to come. The static constraints of size, remoteness, and an array of existing development challenges with the compounding and very immediate threat of climate change make post-COVID recovery in the Pacific particularly vulnerable. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Dame Meg Taylor, Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat, to unpack all of these dynamics. As a pillar of Pacific policymaking for decades, Dame Meg needs no introduction for Pacific Watchers. But for the sake of our broader audience, I will try and keep an overview of her illustrious and intimidating background brief. Dame Meg began her professional life as private secretary to Chief Minister Michael Somare during the self-government of Papua New Guinea prior to independence, and then during his tenure as Prime Minister at the independence of Papua New Guinea. She practiced law in government and the private sector, and sat on the influential PNG Law Reform Commission before taking her career international as PNG's ambassador to the United States, Mexico, and Canada between 1989 and 1994. Meg then moved on to a 15-year career as Vice President in the World Bank Group in charge of the Compliance Advisor Ombudsman. In 2014, Dame Meg was appointed as Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum, the premier regional political grouping of 18 independent and self-governing Pacific states, a position she has held since. Secretary General, welcome to the podcast.
Very pleased to be here, Jonathan, and hello to all who are listening.
Secretary General, I thought we'd start off by having you explain to our audience what is the role of the Pacific Islands Forum and the Secretariat and how that role is changing in the era of COVID-19.
Well, let me just take you back to the history of where it all came from. So in the late 60s, Samoa, Tonga were talking about selling bananas to New Zealand, and then Fiji joined in and the discussion was around how they'd do better if they did it all together. And that led to the trading of bananas with New Zealand. And then, of course, they set up the South Pacific Economic Community, which was very focused on the economic issues. And then in 1971, the South Pacific Forum was created. I think the interesting thing is that next year, 2021, is the 50th anniversary of the forum, which is a big milestone and still going strong. So we have 18 members, 16 states and 2 territories. It's the region's political and economic policy organization. So we support the leaders of the Pacific and the governments of the Pacific to make these key decisions that have impact for the collective of the Pacific. And when I refer to the Pacific or the Blue Pacific, which is the narrative now, I'm referring to all our countries, including Australia, New Zealand, and we cover an area of EEZs of 40 million square kilometers. It's a big ocean continent. And I think for our listeners, I really want them to understand that it's really quite amazing. And the richness of those resources and the people, the cultures, all of them are very important. So over the years, some of the achievements have been particularly around the nuclear-free Pacific on UNCLOS. That's the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea. The island Pacific countries really spearheaded those negotiations at the UN. And of course, more recently, the parties to the Nauru Agreement, which is around the tuna fishing, which has been a real breakthrough in terms of having resource ownership of the fish stock, and the climate debates, the Paris Agreement, and the role that was played by leaders of the Pacific in that agreement, and keeping alive some of the tough political issues, particularly around self-determination and issues on human rights for region around the Pacific. With COVID, I think what's been really obvious is the geopolitical contestation is really heightened. There's a lot of interest in this region, but that's not new. It's probably just been exacerbated because of COVID right now. But if you look at history, it goes back to the 16th century. There was always interest in this region from the Spanish and the French and then the Germans and the British, you know, it goes back. But now we have new dynamics that are playing out, and the Pacific is right in the middle of it, and where areas of interest. So I'll leave it at that.
The Secretariat operates around a fixed calendar of important regional meetings. In particular, the leaders' meeting, held typically in August, September every year, is a critical opportunity for leaders across, as you note, this huge blue continent to come together to hash out these really challenging regional issues. What is the role that you see of this meeting, and what have been the key achievements in your time as SG over the past 5 years?
Well, the role of the Pacific Island Forum is the gathering of the leaders to make the tough political decisions on matters that are of regional importance. And that's what it's all about. I came in at a time when the framework for Pacific regionalism, this was after the review of what they call the Pacific Plan, and Sir Makere Morauta, the former Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, was in charge of bringing all this work together, the consultations within the region, etc. And one of the findings of that review was that there was the lack of the politics in the region. That had gone. When I came in, I think my task was to make sure that the politics was brought back into the debates in the region, that we also brought back streamlined agendas, and also we focus on inclusivity to make sure that the voice of all in the Pacific were heard, civil society, private sector, but individuals who had an opinion that there were mechanisms that could provide for that kind of voice. And for me, this will be an important part of where we are now and where the Pacific goes in the future, is to make sure that when there are tough decisions to be made, that the leadership of the region brings the politics and has the politics in their discussions and debates to be able to deal with these issues that have regional importance. And secondly, I'd say one of the achievements since I've been Secretary General is that I'm really pleased to see the strengthening of relationships between the leaders and a real understanding between them. Let's just go to the tough debates that were had in Tuvalu around the climate issues. And the analogy is about how families, whether you're cousins, whether you're brothers and sisters, you can have tough differences, but there is the political space there to be able to express those views, and there's also an opportunity to be heard, and then you have to find the agreement to go forward. So that's how it plays out. And if people see, and yes, and there was a lot of commentary about all this, the differences between our members, that's my interpretation of what political settlements are about. And that's what was gathered through the Morauta Review. And this is what the atmosphere that I think is of respect, but also of differences, and then finding common positions to go forward. Just one other area that I think that the leaders have really focused on, which I think will really take us into the future, is about this narrative of the Blue Pacific. So what does it mean and why is it important? Well, first of all, the narrative is about identity of who we are as peoples, that we're not isolated from one another. There is this vast ocean, and it's not islands just floating out there. There's a cultural connectedness, there's journeys, there's histories. And that narrative is what can hold this part of the world together and make it very, very important for ourselves in knowing who we are. And I think also understanding the richness of this region, not just in its resources, but in terms of the context of the people and the connectedness to one another. And building on that is what this generation does and the future generations will do, I hope.
Well, let's hope that narrative will last long past your tenure, SG, because I think the Blue Pacific is a very good framing of the Pacific region. As you say, the Leaders Summit is a great opportunity to personalize the differences and the relationships in the region to make those differences seem, I guess, a little bit smaller. Will the leaders' meeting take place this year? I mean, August, September, we're not looking too far away from it. And if not in person, is the Secretariat looking at ways to try and take it digital in 2020?
Oh, we're in discussions at the moment with the Troika on what will be the process going forward.
Right. Well, fingers crossed that we can get a bubble sorted out sooner rather than later and we can actually make it happen in person. One of the key political consensuses that have been reached in recent years in the forum has been that of Bikatawa Plus. Would you mind explaining to our audience what is Bikatawa Plus and how it is relevant in the time of COVID-19?
Bikatawa was there before I came on as Secretary General, and it's really the mechanism to respond to a regional crisis. And many of you will remember that this was really played out during the Ramsey interventions in the Solomon Islands, where all the Pacific got together to help the Solomons. Once that was concluded, it was a clear indication from the leaders when they met in the Solomons was that we needed to continue looking at the regional security agenda. And out of that came the Boy Declaration in 2019 in Nauru. And what that did was it expanded the definition of security to be inclusive of human security, environmental and resource security. Also address transnational crimes, including cybersecurity and building resilience to disasters and climate change. So you've got both the Bickertawa and the Boy Declarations, and they are the parameters of an expanded concept of regional security. We've used this also right now with COVID, where the leaders recognised the region was facing a crisis and triggered the Bickertawa Declaration. And the purpose of it really was to create a political space so that there could be a response to COVID and primarily around the health issues. And people may be wondering, well, how do you create a political space through a declaration for a health issue? Well, you can't just arrive, land an aircraft in any part of the Pacific and say, well, I'm here. I've got a lot of stuff to help you, etc. It doesn't work like that. There's got to be protocols that are in place so that all the countries know exactly what is expected of them, what they expect of others, etc. And that's what we've been working on, particularly over the last 2 months, getting that political space so that when a country requests assistance, then we can assist that country to get the intervention that they need.
Yeah, I imagine having a coordinating authority in time of crisis when there are so many different actors who are looking to make a difference is really critical. And you've framed it around this humanitarian corridor for the region. How is the humanitarian corridor shaping up for the Pacific?
It's been important, particularly to get all our task force together to work on these protocols, which apply to the deployment of technical teams around customs issues, around immigration, around repatriation and diplomatic clearances. So that's the work that we've been focusing on. We are also involved working much more closely with, of course, SPC as the agency for the region, working closely with WHO in terms of making sure that there is sufficient supplies here in terms of health equipment that can get to countries. But getting it into the countries is the challenge, and that's why where we come in is making that sure that that political space is ready when countries want help and then being able to guide that intervention.
I'd like to stay focused on COVID-19 if we can, SG, and I'd like to ask how you assess the state of play in the Pacific in regards to COVID-19, both on the health and economic fronts.
Of the 18 members of the Pacific Island Forum, 6 countries have COVID cases, 12 have no cases, and 9 states have states of emergency in place, and today most of the borders remain closed. So the natural response is to really look inwards when something like this happens. And when you're in islands all across the Pacific, where we are very conscious of our vulnerability, also of our isolation, I think the countries looked inwards. And I think perhaps where the Pacific did do very well in is that there was very quick and decisive action by the leaders to close down their borders and protect themselves. Why? There is a history in this region of epidemics, influenza, of measles, where populations have been decimated. And that history is also very much in folklore in island countries. So when this happened, there was an immediate response on that. So when it comes to the health response, I think there's been a tremendous effort made by our leaders and the support that we've had from larger members of our own organisation, particularly Australia and New Zealand. There's also the economic impact, and that's where it's been devastating. What we're seeing is that countries that really depend on tourism have suffered enormously. Now we're seeing that the airlines that have played a big role in bringing tourists to countries are now laying off up to hundreds of people. But when the economic impact on, say, an industry like tourism, it's not just the people, the hotels, etc. It's about any other business that has an influence to make sure that food is on the table. So it's agriculture, it's the taxi drivers, it's the retailers. All this is impacted. So the economic impact has been substantial. The response of the governments has been, on the economic front, has been important. Finance ministers have sought bilateral assistance, but they've also initiated stimulus package, economic recovery packages, and I think in two of our bigger countries, supplementary budgets. They've sought concessional financing and grants from the international financial institutions. And going forward, they're going to have to look at how we get some relief in terms of debt. The region just can't afford to be servicing its debt when we're under so much economic pressure. The interesting thing is that the loss of jobs has meant that social welfare systems that were lean at best, the ability to be able to cope with that has been tougher. So if these closures go on for a long time, I think it's going to be very tough in terms of the economic recovery. One of the aspects of COVID and then having Cyclone Harold showed was climate change, that existential threat that we've all learned to live with but don't have to live with it, is still there. And I think it was a big shock after all the focus on this pandemic, and then we get hit by Cyclone Harold, which has been devastating for provinces in Vanuatu and in Fiji. And the impact of that, we don't know yet in terms of, you know, percentages of GDP, et cetera, but it was substantial from what I'm being told by leaders in both countries. And I think that having a pandemic like this doesn't mean that we forget what is happening in terms of the climate issues, because as the ocean warms, that has an impact on us and our fisheries, all of us. Whether we're large continents or we're smaller islands, it impacts all of us. These challenges in terms of keeping the temperatures, 1.5 degrees Celsius has been the position of the Pacific Island Forum, that we are not changing, the leaders have not changed their views on this, and the implementation of the Paris Agreement still vital for the Pacific. I would hope that we all can do this together.
You've very well covered the health and economic impacts of COVID on the Pacific, but a lot of people fall back on saying, well, the Pacific is resilient. And a lot of that resilience is born out of these traditional social welfare structures that have traditionally been so strong, but, you know, have been perceived to be getting more stretched. Would you mind expanding on that a little bit, on the social welfare systems in the Pacific?
When I was referring to social welfare, I was talking about state-driven ones, not so much our traditional ones. I'm living in Fiji, where the Secretariat is hosted. My country is Papua New Guinea, and I'm in touch on a weekly basis with my family and community in the Highlands, just to see how everybody's coping. And it's really interesting that in Fiji, I see everybody's planting gardens, including us here at the Secretariat, to make sure that we have food that we can draw on for the months and a year to come. People are producing food in town. So it's impressive to see that everybody's going back to what we all know is our agriculture. In the countries like Kiribati, Tuvalu and Marshall Islands, which are atoll countries, I've not been there, but I know how resilient people are and resorting to relying on their fishing resources to sustain them. But I think what is most important is the fact that our own systems of our families and our extended families and communities, and when you, even for people like me who don't come from the island that I live on, but is that you build these networks of people that you have friendships with and that, and it's of supporting each other. But I think it's going to get harder, some countries, particularly where you've got a greater urban population, where there's been a great reliance on having that cash income to be able to afford food, because the markets are not cheap now, that's gone up, but also to be able to afford medicine and to sustain their families going forward. People will help each other, and people from different countries will help each other within this region. And we've seen that in support, particularly in terms of the medical supplies that we're getting, that countries like Australia and New Zealand have made a great effort to make sure that we have these supplies within our countries, particularly on the medical side. But going forward with the economic downturn, the recovery is going to be tough. And how we get through this, do I have the answers for that? No. But my work is to really look at what has been the economic impact of this, and our economists have done work on this, and then the finance ministers will meet in June and we'll have discussions on this. Of course, there'll be the national response and then what can be done on a regional basis.
Yeah, the scale of the economic crisis for the entire world, but in particular for the Pacific, means that there are few foreign members that on their own will be able to mount the kind of financial firepower to keep their economies on life support and through the crisis, and then to stimulate them on the other side. They're going to need outside assistance, much like we all are. What kind of support are you seeing provided now, and do you think that's going to be enough? And what more do you think is going to be needed in the future? You touched a little bit on debt restructuring. I don't want to get ahead of the June finance ministers meeting, but what are your thoughts on what more is going to be needed in the coming months?
Well, I think that if we can get more grants, I think, you know, creating more debt is going to be hard for the countries, because how are we going to repay it? So getting more grants from international financial institutions and from donor partners to be able to sustain economies. It's going to be hard to sustain economies at the level they were in 2019, but I think going forward, I mean, everybody's looking at how what the budgets are, what the priorities are, and of course, really looking also at our debt restructuring, and that we get some kind of reprieve on that going forward. We hope that in the next 18 months, 2 years, there is a vaccine so that our trade can resume. Also, particularly in the main areas of our economies, can also resume, particularly as the Pacific relies so heavily on tourism.
On tourism, a potential part of a solution that has been getting quite a lot of attention and a fair bit of traction in the past few weeks, both in Australia and New Zealand, has been this concept of a trans-Tasman Pacific bubble or travel bubble. Is this something the forum would endorse? Is there a role for the forum to play here in helping coordinate and establish a set of norms for such an arrangement? Are there any potential concerns for such a bubble?
There's great interest in the bubble that Australia and New Zealand are trying to create. There are some countries that are very interested in being part of that, but there are also countries that are very, very cautious of this. So there's not been a discussion by the leaders on this bubble. The Secretariat itself has not been asked to be part of that discussion, but we're watching it closely, and we're having discussions with all our member states on issues that they are what they're interested in terms of our work. And the bubble is not one that is raised in terms of the collective at the moment. The important thing is this. You see, in reopening, there can be issues for the countries themselves in terms of who comes in. And people and our countries know the vulnerability of this. And if you see guidelines that have been given to countries in terms of opening up, one of the most important things is that you've got to have good health services and you've got to have public health infrastructure that can manage a situation like this. That's a big issue. And if anywhere the dialogue partners wanted to really help is to make sure that we have that in place in our country so that they can reopen and they can be part of Pacific trade and Pacific tourism business again. Some countries are in a better shape than others, and I think this is got to be worked out both bilaterally and also discussed regionally.
And do you think there's going to be a pivot back? You know, we've seen a shift in recent years of attention from the outside focusing on, you know, infrastructure in the Pacific. Do you think post-COVID we might see more of a focus on the fragility of the health systems in some Pacific nations?
I think we've learned a lot from this in terms of just how inadequate the health systems have been. Some countries have done very well, as I said. But if you look at some of the larger countries in the region, if you see the data on it, the expenditures in health have been very low, and this has been part of the issue. I don't think we can wait till after COVID to say that, look, if countries have the resources to assist us, that we'll then invest in health. I think that we're going to need some assistance like now so that we have those facilities in place so that we can open up, so that tourists feel comfortable enough to be in our countries. And I think some of our countries have put resources into that.
Finally, SG, on a more personal note, how do you feel the Secretariat and its functions are going to change for the better coming out of the COVID-19 crisis?
A situation like this for an institution like the Pacific Island Forum Secretariat, but also for all the crop agencies, is that we've really looked at how the modalities of our operation. I think that we've found that we have technical support now. We can run meetings using technology. All the rushing around in the world and in the region for meetings need to be reassessed. Can we conduct a lot of our work using technology, getting together when it's really important, particularly for the ministers and the leaders? But I think in terms of a lot of the work that we need to do, we can do this now virtually. In terms of our own institution, we're very focused on what we deliver, looking at prioritising our agenda, of course, aligning it to the leaders' agenda, but also making sure that we keep our members informed constantly about what we're delivering. That's been our push. And going forward, I would see that hopefully a reduction in all the incessant travelling that we had for meetings and trying to use modalities that keep us at home and the productivity of our own work and the work in the region reach new heights. We've learned from this. I think it's forcing all of us to really improve our technology so that we can, or utilising our technology for the work that we need to do.
Well, that's a great silver lining to end on, SG. And whilst I agree that the use of technology and communications will help shift that balance from physical to digital connections quite a lot, but we don't want to lose the physical altogether. I personally can't wait to get back into the Pacific region and look forward to seeing you and the Secretariat in person sometime soon. But in the meantime, thank you very much for your time here on COVIDcast, and all the best to you and to the Secretariat in the weeks and months ahead.
Thank you.
COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues Sandra Rigby, Darcy Milne and Jennifer Reinhardt for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all of the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.